Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Welcome, everyone, to A Closer Look. I'm Robert Signer, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Sanford Stem Cell Discovery Center, which is part of the UC San Diego Sanford Stem Cell Institute. Today, we're going to be taking a closer look at stem cells in space. Now, I have to admit, when I first heard about this topic, I was a bit skeptical. Why would we study stem cells in space when we could continue studying them here in the confines of laboratories on Earth? Now, what I've come to learn over the past several years is that there are at least three major reasons for pursuing this fundamental research. The first is probably the most obvious, and I think it's really well illustrated in this video. Now, what you're watching here is a time lapse of every SpaceX launch attempt from Cape Canaveral between 2010 and 2023. And as you watch the video, what becomes very apparent is that we are going to space far more frequently, and that people will be continuing to visit and explore space in a way that's really just only continuing to blast off. And so, if more and more people are going to go to space, well, we had better understand what the biological impacts of space travel are going to be on human health. Now, the second reason for studying stem cells in space is probably much less obvious, but is really emerging as being far more impactful than I ever imagined. Right? So space, needless to say, represents a unique environment to our biology. It imposes a completely new type of stresses on our cells, stemming from things like microgravity, that are unlocking mysteries about our biology and providing new systems and platforms for us to interrogate human disease. Incredibly, this is leading to breakthrough discoveries about aging, cancer, and neurological diseases that are not just going to impact astronauts, but are going to affect human health right here on Earth. Now, I'd say that the third major benefit of stem cell research in space is that the unique environment of low Earth orbit isn't just impacting biology, it's impacting chemistry and physics as well. And that's opening new and improved ways to support things like biomanufacturing and drug discovery that aren't necessarily feasible on Earth and could fundamentally change how we produce the cures of tomorrow. So today, you're going to hear from two of the world's leading stem cell scientists whose ongoing research is both figuratively and literally out of this world. Our first expert today is Dr. Katrina Jameson. Dr. Jameson is a leading physician scientist whose clinical expertise treating blood cancers has fueled her transformative research program that has made multiple field-altering discoveries on the cellular and molecular programs governing the emergence and maintenance of cancer stem cells. Dr. Jameson achieved something that most scientists only dream about. Her research and efforts led to the FDA approval of fedratinib, a drug that is revolutionizing the treatment of patients with the blood cancer myelofibrosis. Now, the planet was not sufficient to contain Dr. Jameson's brilliance, and so she has been one of the pioneers of stem cell research in space. She sent the first bioreactors with cancer organoids to space to make new discoveries about the activation of cancer stem cells. And now she's launched experiments on 7 different missions to space. Dr. Jameson earned her MD and PhD at the University of British Columbia. She did clinical fellowships and postdoctoral research at Stanford University and has been at UC San Diego since 2005, where she's now a professor of medicine, the chief of the Division of Regenerative Medicine, the Komen Family Presidential Endowed Chair in Cancer Research, and the founding director of the UC San Diego Sanford Stem Cell Institute. Her remarkable accomplishments have been recognized by numerous prestigious awards, including the MPN Heroes Award, the RELL Sun Award, and the Precision Medicine Luminary Award. Please welcome Dr. Katrina Jameson.
I think the key is we live in one of the most creative, talented, places on earth, as far as I'm concerned, and it's a thrill to be here. I basically live here. We eat most of our meals at Bella Vista. But if you think of the extraordinary things we're able to do in this particular environment, is because we think we can. And because I think it was Jessica that got me the keychain that says failure is not an option, so we have no choice. But when you look at us here, we're all different, we all have different perspectives, and we tend to get those ideas in front of each other, we collaborate, and that's unique. The ability to share data in real time between our academic collaborators with industry, have everybody's voice matters. I think that's what's unique here. I really wanted to say thank you to T. Denny Sanford, who said, go where you can do the most good and where there is the most need. And that's something that he's perpetually invested in here and in all other places where he is. So thank you, Denny, for everything you do for us and the hopeful patients we're trying to help with what is quite literally a cancer moonshot. So as Rob mentioned, we've been studying stem cell pathways, aging, and cancer evolution. You see that adds up to space. And when I went to NASA headquarters March 21st, I got to meet some of the most brilliant, talented people I've ever met outside of this place. And they match in innovation, ingenuity. And basically, that's the NASA administrator there with Javier Becerra, the Health and Human Services Secretary, the head of the NCI, and a lot of astronauts that want to know, what are we doing here to look at stem cell fitness, and when can we do that for them? So we had a nice chat about how stem cells can go awry. Our stem cells are really important for regenerating our tissues. We have bone marrow stem cells. They were the first stem cells to be identified, actually in 1961 by Till and McCullough as a functional unit in Canada, and then later by Irv Weissman, where he was able to purify stem cells in the mouse and then in humans in 1988 and 1992, respectively. So we've got a lot of information about our blood stem cells, not so much about the neural stem cells that Alison Motry will talk about. That's a much tougher field. But we've had a lot of history in terms of understanding how stem cells evolve to become pre-malignant and malignant. So we know that there's something called clonal hematopoiesis, where our stem cells can acquire mutations and then ultimately give rise to daughter cells that learn to clone themselves. But unlike my son, who thinks he can put on the brakes, he doesn't do it at the right time when he's driving. So that's what the progenitors are like. They stop knowing how to block this cloning capacity. So we've been working on these different pathways as a field. Certainly Rob Signer has contributed substantially to this field in terms of understanding our stem cell aging. But really we want to know, how did we acquire mutations that lead to pre-malignant conditions like myeloproliferative neoplasms, these precancerous conditions? You'll hear from a patient advocate later to see why it matters and when does this happen. So when I talk to patients in clinic, they say, hey doc, how did I get this? I didn't get exposed to radiation. I didn't get exposed to benzene. What happened here? How much of this happened very, very early in life because of exposures to potentially viral infections that can activate mutating enzymes? So this was a study done at Cambridge, and basically Jody Nangalia and colleagues showed that this JAK2 mutation that is a driver of a lot of the myeloproliferative neoplasms can occur as early as 9 years old. And now we're thinking maybe it even happens in utero. So in other words, before birth. And so we started looking at these enzymes that are activated in response to stressors in the environment. These APOBEC enzymes are really part of our backup immune response, and they evolve to actually get rid of retroviruses like HIV. We know that they're the number two signatures in all cancers, so APOBECs induce a C to T mutation signature. And we know that this is the number two signatures in all cancers because of Ludmil Alexandrov, who you'll see is in this paper, but they're activated in response to stress and inflammatory growth factors, and this can happen because of viral infections that just won't go away like COVID, or just stressors where we're anticipating stress, and this is the great new find. So I'll talk a little bit about the dark matter of the genome. So when I used to watch Star Trek as a kid, we'd hear about space, the final frontier, and how there's dark matter out there. Well, we have so-called dark matter in our genome, or what my mom calls the Darth Vader of the genome. So all of these non-coding sequences that actually are really important. So human endogenous retroviral sequences can be activated under conditions of stress, and these APOBEC enzymes get turned on to try and repress that. But in the process of trying to repress the human endogenous retroviral sequences, they actually introduce C to T mutations.
So what happens if ApoBec gets activated? So we have 7 ApoBecs. They're human specific. You cannot study this in a mouse. You cannot study it in a zebrafish or a fruit fly. This is human-specific biology. We evolved to do this because we cannot afford to have genomic instability because we're supposed to live over 80 years. And as you'll see in the longevity seminar that we do next, maybe 103 years with a person who will be speaking there. So we have to protect our genome from these invading retroviruses, and that's where the ApoBex come in. If the ApoBex get turned on for too long, then you activate another enzyme called ADAR. So ADAR doesn't mutate our DNA, it changes our RNA. So if you think of the DNA as the blueprint for your house, the RNA is the engineer's interpretation, and the protein is actually the builder. All three can go awry in cancer. And what we're focusing on today is DNA and RNA, and specifically ADARP150. So this is an isoform of ADAR. We didn't want to look at this. This is too complicated. It's tough biology, but it's activated in response to inflammation. And this is a talk we'll hear about from a Nobel laureate, Tom Cech, in October. These sequences called G-quadruplex sequences, again, human-specific drivers of cancer evolution that ADAR is able to bind to. The other thing we know is ADAR responds to IL-6, so it turns out ApoBec activates IL-6 production and drives more ADAR. Why does ADAR matter? ADAR is on our radar because it's a cancer cloning gene, and it allows cancer to evade the immune system. But let's start in the beginning. How do cancers evolve? This is why we started working with NASA. And basically what happened with the NASA twin study is we started to see the inflammatory growth factors that activate this enzyme ApoBec3C. And this is work done by Jane Isquith, who's wearing the cat outfit. Hello, Jane. And others in the lab. Basically what we see in patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms is if they've all activated this ApoBec3C enzyme, and it gets more activated as the disease progresses because there's more inflammation that begets more inflammation. The reason ApoBec3C matters is it allows the pre-leukemic cells to clone themselves. The other thing is it allows those pre-leukemic cells to outgrow the normal cells, and this is dependent on the C2T editing, because when Jane mutates the editing domain, you just don't get that proliferative burst. So Jane started this project with my daughter, Isabella. Yes, you can rope your poor family members into science, and now she's doing her master's in regenerative medicine at Edinburgh University. She thinks science is fun still. She may change her mind soon, but we'll see. But then what happened in the lab is we started to find that ApoBec, when activated, can actually not only induce ADAR, it actually binds to it. So we thought this was a very important finding. And people who progress with myeloproliferative neoplasms have activated both ApoBec3C and ADAR. So we have biomarkers. We like to make them digital. And we'll hear about digital biomarkers coming up from Alex, our patient advocate, who happens to be rather brilliant. But anyway, what we found was ADAR is a tumor suppressor. And it can, when it's not working properly, create the capacity for cancer to clone itself. We can dial this down a little bit with that drug, fedratinib, that Rob mentioned that we were involved in helping to develop, that's FDA approved. But every time I think I'm being clever, somebody else has done an even better job and done it on a grander scale. And this is an example of that. So our lab first discovered ADAR and activation in cancer stem cell populations. But then Han Liang and Gordon Mills showed it was active in 17 different tumor types when they became resistant to therapy. So we thought that was pretty interesting. The other thing is, it seems to be not just a cancer cloning gene and mechanism of therapeutic resistance, but it actually is a very strong immune evasion signal. So this was discovered by Nicholas Haining at Harvard and Alan Herbert. So basically, here's a cancer that can clone itself and also have a cloaking shield like the Klingons in Star Trek. You'll hear a lot of Star Trek stuff because that's what I grew up watching. We were working on a drug starting in 2014 with the head of chemistry and biochemistry here, Michael Burkhardt, and his team. And we thought, well, it's a splicing modulator. And we didn't realize that what we had in our hands was actually an ADAR inhibitor because it prevented splicing-mediated activation of ADAR until Jessica said, hey, I think this is blocking ADARP150 production. And there's Jessica over there. She's always shy about these things, but I try to ignore her. And then Phoebe said the same thing. Wen said the same thing. Larissa said, of course, why didn't you realize this before? ADAR has to be activated into P150 to be the immune silencer and the cancer cloning gene. So with the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, we did the pre-IND enabling studies. We did this with Leslie Cruz, Wen Zhu Ma, basically our whole lab, Mike Burkhart, all working together, Peggy Wentworth. We finished the pre-IND studies. It looked really good in myelofibrosis and leukemia stem cells in AML. And then the FDA said, but what about working on this in pediatric AML? And we said, well, we don't know anything about pediatric AML. They said, please consider the Pediatric Research Equity Act when you develop this drug because kids need better therapies. And patients with AML, when they're kids, have a 35% relapse rate. So anyway, with Inga Vanderwerf and others in the lab, we showed it is even more potent in preclinical models of pediatric AML. So it looks like we've got a drug potentially called brubexinib that I'll go into a little bit more detail about. But the real question is, how do precancers turn into cancer? And how much of this is stress? How much can we predict, prevent, and reverse? How much of cancer coming back is because we're anticipating stress, that sympathetic nervous system response? And this is something that I think all of us will want to know, because one in three women will get cancer at some point in their life, one in two men. So it behooves us all to think of ourselves as patient advocates and think about what we would take, what we would think about if we're concerned about developing cancer. And this is where the NASA twin study comes in. So Scott Kelly was up in space for 340 days compared to his identical twin brother. And there's one person in the back of the room who also has a twin, who's our executive director, Michelle Ghani. So anyway, what happened to Scott Kelly is he came back 2 inches taller, which seemed like a bonus, but he had immune dysfunction, premalignant changes in the blood that included translocations and inversions, and inflammatory growth factor overexpression. So we wrote a grant, this is Allison Motree and Janice Studemeyer and I and Space Tango, to say maybe we can learn things about how cancer evolves faster in space, because it looks like Scott Kelly came back with pre-leukemic changes and inflammatory growth factor upregulation. So this got into the Washington Post because it was the world's first integrated space stem cell orbital research lab, iScore, after Canadian hockey. And what we did was 4 missions to the ISS with Jessica and Jane holding the Cube Lab in experiments we did in collaboration with Space Tango. What we did was we used the cell cycle reporter that we developed with Roger Chen's former postdoc. Roger Chen, you may remember, got the Nobel Prize for GFP. And basically what we see on the ground in these nanobioreactors where we put stem cells that are labeled with a cell cycle reporter is they maintain this healthy, sleepy stem cell population. Our normal stem cells in the blood need to be asleep 80% of the time to maintain their full potency. After 3 weeks in the bioreactor, they're still there. There are lots of red cells. They're staying healthy. They're staying sleepy. What happens in space after just 10 days is they hyperproliferate, which at first doesn't seem like a problem, except they get exhausted. And those stem cells have partied a little too much. And the question is, will they recover? Well, we passed these stem cells, with Jessica Pham being our stellar mission specialist, to Ludmila Alexandrov's team. Shuvro did the telomere length analysis, and he found that the telomeres tended to shorten. So the telomeres are on the ends of our chromosomes, and they're preventing our chromosomes from unraveling. And basically, that stem cell telomere shortening suggests that the lifespan of the stem cell may be reduced. What Larissa Blaine found was that there was decreased survival of the colonies coming back from space, and they also lack the capacity to replate, or in other words, clone themselves. So that really goes with a stem cell exhaustion signature. And then I just want to focus on this one thing. The other thing that went down in space was that cloning gene called ADARP150. So our normal stem cells need some ADARP150. Cancer stem cells use this, like rocket fuel. But the stem cells need a little bit, and they were starting to become deprived in that. And this is where we get to the dark matter of the genome. So what we found in space was activation of human endogenous retroviral sequences called HERVs. They massively upregulated in space, and we think in response to that, APABEC got overexpressed. When APABEC overexpression occurs, we see the C to T mutagenesis signature. We saw that in all flight versus ground samples. That recapitulated what Jane sees when she overexpresses APABEC 3C. And it's exactly what we see in my patients with myeloproliferative neoplasm. So that's a pre-leukemic disorder. So the bottom line is APABEC is the rocket fuel, and ADAR is the liquid oxygen that allows precancer to become fully malignant. So we've developed special reporters. This is with Inga and others in the lab that tell us when splicing has gone awry. We've got the ADAR reporter. We've got these bioreactors. So in the final minute, I'll just tell you all the work that Jessica and our team have done with the tumor organoids. We've expanded the biorepository to about 1,500 samples with Inga van der Werf, Emma, and Antonio, and others in the lab. And basically what we found in the Axiom 1 mission is tumor organoids triple in size in just 10 days, and they activate ADAR. They uber activated. And so Jessica said, we can't stop there. We've got to see if we can block it. So on the Axiom 2 mission, we found fedratinib reduces ADAR a very little bit. Rubexinib does it big time. We repeated this experiment with Axiom 3 and found rubexinib is a much more potent inhibitor of ADAR and prevents triple negative breast cancer organoids from growing. This got into Fortune magazine. Thanks, Danielle and Aaron, for doing that. We've never had raw data go into a magazine before, but that generated interest from the astronauts who said, can you test this on us? Can you see if we're developing these pre-leukemic changes? And we just had the meeting with the Axiom 2 and 3 crew this morning to give them the results of their single-cell sequencing from their recent missions. So what we're really trying to do in these NASA-funded experiments and Sanford Stem Cell Institute experiments is see, can we predict, prevent accelerated stem cell aging, particularly when it becomes pre-malignant and malignant? So I'd like to thank everyone in the lab for working so incredibly hard, our sponsors, and then think about space as an accelerant and a very exhilarating place to do science. And think about all of us as colleagues that can do what seems to be impossible. Medicine informing novel discoveries. So thank you for being here. I'd like to thank my family, particularly my mom, who keeps saying, follow the data, even though she's not a scientist. She reads all the journals. My sister, Chris, my younger sister, Barb, and you know, my dad for inspiring me to do science. And that's it for me. I'll be happy to answer questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jameson. Our second expert today turns science fiction into science. Dr. Allison Motrie is a leading researcher studying brain evolution and utilizing stem cells to study neurological diseases. Now, a key technology that Dr. Motrie helped pioneer and that he leverages in his research are brain organoids. These are essentially mini brains grown in a dish that have empowered new breakthroughs in neuroscience, a greater understanding of diverse neurological conditions, and serve as a powerful platform to screen and discover new therapies. In 2019, Dr. Motrie took brain organoids to new heights, initiating their study on the International Space Station. Dr. Motrie earned his PhD from the University of São Paulo in Brazil and carried out postdoctoral research as a Pew Latin American Fellow at the Salk Institute, and has been at UC San Diego since 2008, where he is now Professor of Pediatrics, Director of the Stanford Stem Cell Education and Integrated Space Stem Cell Orbital Research Center, and co-director of the University of California Gene Therapy Initiative. His incredibly creative and cutting-edge research has been recognized by numerous prestigious awards, including the NIH Director's New Innovator Award, the Rockstar of Innovation Award, and the NIH Eureka Award. Please welcome Dr. Allison Motrie.
So as Rob alluded, my lab grows mini brains, and I'll explain to you in a minute what this means, in space. And most of you might be asking, why on earth this guy is growing human brains in space? And there is a reason for that. And let me step back for a moment to tell you that my lab actually focuses on neurological conditions such as autism, epilepsy, and other psychiatric conditions. So we want to help those kids and even adults to have a better life, a better quality of life. And so unfortunately, some of these genetic conditions actually start in uterus. And that's a barrier, an experimental barrier to actually understand how the brain is formed inside the uterus. So the whole idea of creating brain organoids or mini brains outside the uterus or in the lab is that you can have a reductionist model system so you can understand how these conditions appears in the first place. So the way we do it is by working with human pluripotent stem cells. These are stem cells that have the ability to differentiate or specialize in different tissues of your body. And we can guide them towards the brain using ectopic factors that will fool the cells thinking that they need to differentiate or to specialize in brain cells. So this is how the pluripotent stem cells look like. Each one of these dots is a cell. We start with single cells, and then we neuralize them with these ectopic factors. In the case, we use dual SMAD inhibitors, so we are pushing them towards the cortical fate. After a while, we stimulate the growth of these progenitor cells using FGF and EGF, so they just expand. And then we remove the growth factors, we add some differentiation factors, and we let them mature. So we start with single cells. We end up with spheres that contains about 5 million cells in there. Among the cells, 2.5 million neurons, the equivalent of a bee brain. And these structures are quite remarkable. So if you haven't seen one of them, this is Isabel. She was a former postdoc in the lab handling a plate full of brain organoids. Each one of these white dots is a very early stage brain organoid, but they can grow. So they reach 0.5 centimeter in diameter, so you can actually see them at naked eye. And in the beginning, they were not super active because the early protocols that was developed didn't actually give the neurons the substrate to become quite active. So through a series of optimization in the protocol, we were able to get organoids that can actually fire and form networks. And the way we measure that is by plating them on top of a multi-electrode arrays. These are plates that contains electrodes printed in the bottom of the dish, so they can capture the electrical activity over time. So this is a non-invasive technology that you can use to see how the brain organoids evolve over time. And together with Brad Wojtek here at Cognitive Neurosciences, what we learn is that these organoids, after like 2 or 3 months, they start to develop neural oscillations, meaning that the cells start to become quite organized and complex over time. So by 9 or 10 months, the complexity of this network is really something remarkable, unprecedented in tissue culture or in the lab before. So to the point that we can even compare these neural oscillations that are generated by EEG, which is electrodes that you place throughout your skull. And the comparison, it's here we have the predicted age from the EEGs with the actual age, and we are comparing human brains to the brain organoid. So the dotted line is the perfect correlation. The human brain is in black. The organoid data is in blue. And although it's quite variable, it follows the same trajectory, which is quite remarkable that those small organoids created in the lab can actually do that. There is one limitation of the model here. After a year or so, they plateau. So we don't see an increase in complexity. And for a while, I was looking for different ways to age these cells so they can reach like a higher level of complexity, so we can mimic a more adult human brain instead of an early developmental brain. And that's when I stumbled across the data from space. People have been sending cells to space, not brain cells, but other cells to space. And there are reports showing evidence for accelerated aging. So we decided to try. So since 2019, we have been sending like brain organoids to space almost every year. We are also motivated by the NASA Twins experiments. Kat has described a little bit of those experiments. I extracted just one data that I think it's important here. So this is the cognitive test performed by the two brothers, the astronaut and the one that stays on ground, on a pre-flight, during flight, and post-flight. And I hope you can appreciate that the blue curve over there, which is the behavior of the astronaut who stays at the space station, is always lower compared to his twin brother, meaning that he has a very low level of cognition for several aspects that were tested, and that cannot be reverted back to normal even after 6 months post-flight, which is a problem for the astronauts. I mean, we want these guys to become to maintain or to keep their cognition, but this data is actually showing that there is a detrimental effect of space environment in the human brain. So based on those evidences, we decided to send the first batch of organoids, and we do that in an autonomous way, in partnership with Space Tango. So these are shoe boxes that contains all the tissue culture, all the microenvironment to keep these brain organoids alive. The only thing that the astronaut has to do is actually to place these boxes inside the cabinet, so we have full control of the boxes in there. And what we are learning, both from gene expression, proteomics, and molecular pathways, that there is evidence for accelerated aging when these cells return back to Earth. Moreover, we can even compare our data to the NASA twins experiments and find genes that might be driving this accelerated aging in different tissues. So these are a couple of examples here. In one of these missions, we also send brain organoids from Rett syndrome. And Rett syndrome is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's under the spectrum of autism. It's quite severe. Those kids, after 1 year of apparently normal development, they start regressing. So they stop talking, they stop eating, they stop moving. So they end up in a wheelchair. And what we learned from Rett syndrome is that similar to what has been seen in cats' data or in others' data, we see a higher expression of retrovirus, or there's a viral pathway that gets activated in these cells. And so this viral pathway is quite interesting because we're not infecting these organoids with any virus. So the only way for this viral pathway to be activated is if it's coming from endogenous retroelements. And here is the deal. We have shown before that MECP2, the gene that causes Rett syndrome, can control the expression of these aligned retrotransposons in the brain. So it was not a big surprise to see that in the absence of MECP2, we have this upregulation of retroelements, and they might be the ones driving this molecular pathway. So if you don't know, line elements are on the dark side of the genome. These are often called the junk DNA with no apparently functional to the genome. And we previously show here using a reporter EGFP that neuroprogenitor cells can actually activate these line elements. This activation is enhanced by lacking MECP2, again, the gene mutated in Rett syndrome. So what we show is that this upregulation of line elements is actually present in glia cells or astrocytes. These are cells that helps the brain to form synapses, but they also senses dangers in the brain, such as a viral infection. Because of that, they can trigger an inflammatory response, and I'm showing here one of the pro-inflammatory cytokines, IL-6, that is actually elevated in Rett syndrome brains compared to controls. So now, if you have a driver of these inflammation, is this neurotoxic? So we took the same amount of IL-6 that was upregulated in these astrocytes and we exposed them to human neurons, just normal, control, healthy human neurons. And I'm showing here three data before and after the addition of IL-6. The first one is the number of synapses. You can see that this level of IL-6 reduces the number of synapses, reduces the complexity of the neurons. Their arborization actually gets simpler. And also the firing of those neurons is also reduced. So IL-6 in those levels is quite toxic. So we postulated that this might be at least contributing to the disease. And if that's the case, if we block the line elements that are in the astrocytes, we should ameliorate the disease phenotype. And we can see here These are images of brain organoids. You have your controls, you have your MECP2 knockout or Rett syndrome organoids, and after a treatment with the reverse transcriptase inhibitors that blocks line elements, you can rescue the size of these organoids. You can also rescue the neurons inside of the organoids. So the graphic here shows in the first bar the control firing of the neurons, the mutant firing of the neurons, and then the ones treated with the reverse transcriptase. So by inhibiting line elements inside of the organoids, you actually increase the activity of neurons. So we then use a mouse model that lacks MCP2 to see if the treatment with these antiretroviral drugs could actually work. And by looking at the anatomy of those neurons, we can compare the controls on top with the mutants in the middle. The number of spines is reduced in the mutants compared to controls, but you can rescue the number of spines by using these reverse transcriptase inhibitors, which, by the way, these are repurposed drugs from HIV. So we're not creating like a new antiviral, we're just repurposing the drug that is already FDA approved. But most impactful is the fact that these animals, they die after 4 weeks. And if you start the treatment just before they die, something amazing happens, they survive. Not only they survive, but their health gets much better. So it's almost like rescuing something that's about to die with just like antiretroviral therapy. So we're quite excited about that. This was a collaboration with Kenichi Nakashima in Japan. We actually reached out to the same data totally independently, and it was in a meeting that we realized that we have data that could overlap. They have seen the inflammation pathway in Rett syndrome. They didn't know the causes or the mechanism. When I told them to treat with reverse transcriptase inhibitors, he was surprised, but he did the experiments, and here you go. We see like a positive effect. So we are so excited with that we hope that we're going to start a clinical trial for Rett syndrome patients starting this year. We should be recruiting soon. And also, I would like to take this opportunity to say that our model could actually help diseases of late onset, such as Alzheimer's and dementia, which causes like a huge burn to the health system. So this is the impact of this industry up to projected to the 2030. So it's quite a lot of money that is involved on that. And our approach is to find new drugs based on plants that are coming from the Amazon. So to do that, we team up with the University of Amazon, and they are curating neuroactive plants coming from different plants. And we do that in what we call a neuropharmacology or an ethnic pharmacology by talking to the native tribes and find what they use to protect their brains because of the low level of dementia and Alzheimer's in these communities. So I'll show here a video of our project. So this is, again, going back to the Amazon where we talk to these tribes and we are collecting their knowledge inside an AI application that we place inside these little robots that we parachute inside of the Amazon. So the robots start exploring the forest and tell us when they find the plants so the natives can go back and collect the plants and replant over there as well so that we're not destroying anything. And the idea is to have like a curation of these molecules so we can test using all optical electrophysiology in a platform that contains the organoids inside the International Space Station. So the reason why we're looking to the Amazon is because there is over like 200,000 plants over there, most of it totally unknown by modern science. So we're just trying to rescue this kind of knowledge and apply back to modern diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. So there are other applications on Earth that we think that this model can help. Rejuvenation or even health aging might be something that we want to also work on. So let me finish here with take-home messages. So I think like growing brain organoids, and this is likely true to other tissues, can teach us about the impact on the astronaut health, in this case, cognition. But this accelerated aging model can also provide us a platform to screen drugs or to model diseases here on Earth. And our platform, again, can be used to become neuroprotective or to find drugs that are neuroprotective. So I'll finish here with like my vision to the future. So these autonomous platforms or even the astronauts that we currently have are no experts in brain organoids. This takes like almost like a year to train someone to actually really do that. So our vision for the future is actually to train our scientists to become astronauts and not the other way around. So we hope that by doing that, we can create stem cell labs in future space stations so we can grow the brain organoids and deliver them back to Earth for all these applications. So I'll finish here with thanking my funding agencies, different members of my lab that I didn't mention. These are lots of projects going on here, and my collaborators. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Motri. We actually have a very special guest who's joining us today. Her name is Alex Allen. So Ms. Allen is a software engineer who began her diagnostic journey 6 years ago when she was diagnosed with essential thrombocytosis, a stem cell disorder in which the bone marrow starts to make too many platelets. Now, between her professional career working to bring new technology into clinical research, and as a patient of our very own Dr. Jameson, Alex is passionate about advancing the union of technology and wellness. She's agreed to share her story with us today. So please welcome Alex Allen.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me here. So my career has been very much focused, I think, in software. There's a lot of ways that you can do harm, whether that's figuring out all the links you click on and sending you ads that make you spend more money than you meant to, or other things. There's a lot of ways to do harm. And when I started my professional journey, a huge focus was how can I help? And so I got into biotech. I started working in genetics. My career has now taken me into, like Kat said, trying to get digital biomarkers into clinical trials. How can we make sure we get those results faster? And so I have been where you guys are sitting a lot of times in my career. When I was at Illumina, I got to hear all the patients' stories, all the people that we helped as we progressed our work in genetics. And all of that came as a huge comfort to me when I started my own diagnostic odyssey. So 6 years ago, I was working on a very, very stressful project. My sequencer was about to go live. We had some team changes, and I started to notice there's a lot of hair coming out when I'm showering. I should go see a doctor about that. So I go see a doctor. He looks at me, answering my team messages on my phone, answering my Outlook messages, telling him my hair's falling out, and he makes a really great diagnosis. He goes, I'm pretty sure it's stress, Alex. I think it might be stress. But he's going to get some more evidence. He sends me out for a routine blood test. That blood test is what sent me on my journey. He called me a couple of days later. He said, I've never seen this before. Your platelet count doesn't have a number, it just says critical. Do you have another doctor that you see? From there, I ended up being able to schedule an appointment with a GP. But you know, I was in my 20s, so I didn't have one. So that took a month and a half. And he's told me, you have this crazy high platelet count. Try not to be stressed. And okay, I came there because I was stressed. And now you've told me I've got something wrong with me, but I have no idea what it is. So I want you guys to know I achieved Zen in that moment, going, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. And so then I get a month and a half, I finally get to a GP. She says, I can't tell you what you have. It could be this group of disorders that include leukemia, which is very comforting to hear. It could be internal bleeding, and that's why you're making platelets. And it could be something else wrong entirely. And I'm just going to have to send you out for a total barrage of tests and try to find the answer. And so she does. I go get MRIs and x-rays and everything under the sun. She sends me for two different genetic tests, both of which come back negative. And then, only then, will my insurance let me go to a specialist. And in that hospital that I was at, there was only one who had ever seen anyone with a disorder like mine. And he had a 3-month-long waiting list, and he had only had 3 patients with anything close to what I had. And still, she couldn't give me an answer on if I had it. She couldn't give me treatment. She could just tell me, don't be stressed. Don't get stressed, it's bad for your health. Which was like, oh yeah, okay, I'm very calm, I'm very calm. And so for those 3 months, I had to go through this horrible, horrible feeling of just, you know, what do I tell my family? You know, they've told me I could have leukemia. Do I tell my family that? I don't know what I have. I could have nothing. And so I didn't really have a support network, because how do you go ask for help for something you don't know you have? And so the only support that I found was that time that I had been you, where I was that person getting inspiration to keep doing my job and keep helping people. And I got to hear about people on this side of the podium who went through, you know, I had 4 months. That's nothing. I would hear from people who had 5 years, 8 years looking for answers. And just knowing that they went through that, that was my light. That was my safety net. That was my peer. I couldn't talk to them, but I knew that there was somebody out there like that. And so finally, 3 months go by, I get to talk to my specialist. He's the one that actually ran the right test. And you guys heard a little bit from Kat, the way the mutations work. Sometimes it can be in the DNA, sometimes it's in RNA. So the wrong tests were run, which is why they couldn't give me the diagnosis originally. And so they're finally able to give me treatment. My platelet counts go down. They don't tell me I can get stressed again, but I do, because work is sometimes stressful. But time passes. The medication that I'm on has limitations. You know, in your 20s, it's really easy to be on a medication where you can't start a family, where you, you know, maybe might want to make other choices. And so with that doctor, who was an amazing doctor, he had a few patients like me. But when it did come time for me to start saying, I'm in my 30s, I have these goals, I want a family, I have a nephew I love, I'd love to have something like that for myself too. He sent me for a second opinion with Kat. And she was able to talk to me about things that I had never heard before. Before I even got to see her, somebody in her clinic asked me a bunch of questions no one had ever asked me. They go, do you have trouble finishing a thought? And I was like, oh, yes, I think I have adult onset ADHD, but I haven't sought a diagnosis. I'm pretty sure that might be your disorder. News to me, that's amazing. They asked me things like, do you have night sweats? I said, I thought my duvet was too warm. But it's the difference, it's night and day when you go to a clinic where there is somebody who has specialized their whole life in exactly what you have and can see all of the symptoms in front of you and hear the little tiny voice of your disorder against your entire orchestra of your body. And so with Kat, I just was able to get better answers and just the right treatment. And I feel like I just have such a beautiful outlook. And so after all of that time and darkness of trying to figure out, you know, what is wrong with me? What can I say? It's so wonderful now to be able to be in the light and be able to be here and share how all of this research, stem cells in space, can make a difference for me as I look for new treatments that are going to be more effective and keep me going for longer. And so when I was asked to come here, that was the first reason I had that I wanted to be here. I wanted to hopefully inspire you guys to keep pushing for more science and more treatment and more investigation into these disorders. And then I had one other reason, which was, you know, I'm a big Star Wars nerd. I'm a big Marvel fan. Somebody said, do you want to come talk about stem cells in space? And I said, yes, yes, I really would. So that's why I'm here. Thank you, guys.
Thank you to all of you for brilliant talks and sharing your wonderful stories. We're going to try to have a little bit of a discussion here in time and hopefully take some questions from the audience as well. But I thought I'd start with the first couple of questions. And I want to start with you, Alex. As a patient, right, or someone who's been battling this, and all of a sudden you hear that the research that's moving forward to help you, now that's going to start happening in space. What do you think when you hear something like that?
Have you seen the show For All Mankind?
I've seen some of it, yeah.
So I was like, I got to go re-binge watch that show and find out what exactly is going on. But no, I just think it's remarkable. You know, space is such an interesting thing in general, and to know that that's how much people care, I think that was my first thought. Kat told me NASA cares about your disorder. And I had spent a long time being told I have a rare disorder and thinking nobody cares. So to hear that NASA cares enough to send stem cells into space to try to cure it or to try to make better treatment for it, that was just remarkable. I felt like someone's listening.
Thanks. So when we often hear about space, you know, we think about the future, even though it's the present. So I want to ask a question about the future. Dr. Jameson, Kat, where do you think that these sort of experiments in space are going to be in, say, 10 years from now? How is it going to be different than it is today?
Well, I think we're going to make Alex very busy because it's going to come down to new digital biomarkers that she's going to develop for herself and everyone else. You know, this is something that's hugely important. It's what Allison and our team are discovering, that there are these retroviruses in our genome that seem to be reactivated in space, and maybe that's at the root cause of some of these pre-leukemic disorders, and we can stop them in their tracks. So I think the future is very bright because we're working with the brightest and the best in this room. We've got Janice Studemeyer here, Pinar, hello. You know, we just found out today that we're going to get a very big NASA grant to make rubexinib a drug, and we're trying to get it into the clinic by December or January because there are some people that can't wait. So that sense of urgency is something that NASA always has. Teresa in the audience has made a very big discovery about, you know, ADAR being a metastatic switch. I didn't get a chance to talk about that because I'll be stealing her thunder. That's a big story. But we're discovering a lot of things about how cancer gets started and how it propagates itself. But as Allison was alluding to, how our stem cells age. And I think as we understand, well, maybe aging isn't going that well, we can start to reverse that aging process that is accelerating. And we understand that faster in space. So when we wrote the first grant with Janice Studemeyer, she said, just watch. It's just going to be different. I didn't expect space to be an accelerator of all the things that we need to understand about human biology at the stem cell level. So we can't wait to work with you, Rob, on this.
I'm looking forward to it. So Dr. Motri, I have to ask, you know, as a scientist, I've been doing things, and it never occurred to me from the beginning that I should be doing my experiments in space. So what inspired sort of that first decision to take your, you know, research platform and send it to the International Space Station?
Yeah, I know that's a great question. I think, as I briefly mentioned, it was driven by the science. We are looking for ways to age the brain cells so we can have better models here on Earth. So that was the first idea. We had like lots of other crazy ideas along the way, but that was the one that really pushes me forward to improve the model. So we are lacking like a really good neurological model. As I mentioned, the brain starts in uterus, and then for the rest of your life, it stays inside of a skull. So we don't have good technology to look into synapses or what happens at the molecular level. So these are all non-invasive technologies that gives you like just a glimpse of what's happening to the brain. So we need to understand exactly what happens at the molecular, cellular, and network levels. And I think the motivation to take this to space was really to improve that model system.
I see one over there. If you say it out loud, I will repeat it for you. So let me repeat the question first. So the question is about the reactivation of endogenous retroviruses, and that when this happens, this can often affect the neighboring genes. So have you looked in the context of your experiments to see if the activation of those neighboring genes can serve as a biomarker for exactly what you're looking for and the activation of these retroviruses?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Donahoe, for an erudite question as usual. Yes, so we've looked at the activation of human endogenous retroviral sequences, HERVs for short, because it takes too long to say that. We see activation of that whole subset of non-coding RNAs, and what we think is that actually there is repression of ADAR, and that's why they're able to come out. And then what we see is activation of APOBEC that then tries to get turned on. APOBEC turns on IL-6 transcription. You see that? I'm just saying. So they're downstream IL-6 target genes that were seen, and actually Jessica has IL-6 overexpression in the cytokines from the nanobioreactors that went into space. So all of those flight versus ground samples, the stem cells that went in the nanobioreactors have an APABEC activation signal that Jane Isquith was able to resolve by actually cloning APABEC. But it's a little bit more complex than that when we look at real people. And so the thing is, this is maybe something we didn't quite anticipate, but something that Alex kept talking about, and that's stress. When we're stressed, when we think about something stressful, we actually, some of us, have a major fight or flight response, ironically, because it's about a flight. So we saw changes in the astronauts before the flight. So we studied both the Axiom 2 and 3 crew, and we're seeing some changes that suggest that some of these sympathetic nervous system-driven activation of stem cell mobilization drivers actually change gene expression. So we're looking at single cell sequencing with ELSA. We're looking at this with Tom Weisnet, and also whole genome sequencing with Ludmila Alexandrov pre-flight day minus 45, day minus 2. So we're seeing these changes day minus 2. So that means they're thinking about it. And if you think about all of our responses to stress, they're different. Some people are cool cucumbers. They're fine. But then they show the signs of stress later. They've internalized it all, and we're seeing that as well. So I think it's a very interesting and complex question, and we'll actually have to understand it in people. But fortunately, with NASA, we can do both. And with our implementation partners like Axiom, Space Tango, nascent companies that are evolving in this unique environment, I think we'll get the answers faster. So I think the biggest surprise from space is that it accelerates discoveries. It accelerates our understanding of human biology and what really matters to potentiate stem cell aging and precancer as it evolves to cancer.
So I want to follow up with a question about stress. There's sort of course, the saying, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? And so this is sort of true sometimes for biological stressors, right? Where experience of a stress sometimes confers memory that makes you stronger to resist stress in the future. Is there any evidence of this happening in regards to spaceflight or you know, the exposure to these sort of extreme environments and stressors?
I love this question because we didn't see it in the nanobioreactor, but we're actually seeing it in the astronauts. So humans have a lot more potential to recover intact than our little stem cells when we put them in this little nanobioreactor. So we're seeing activation of a backup stem cell pathway that comes up in the astronauts day plus 30 to day plus 45 after return. So it is making them stronger. They're calling up a backup stem cell population. This is Patrick Chang, Tom Weisnet, Jessica Pham, our whole biorepository getting, 450 normal age bone marrow samples with Anna Kachatrain now. She used to be Anna Kalugian. So we've got Inga Vanderwerf, who runs our biorepository. I think we've got Emma and Antonio, Thomas. We've got a big team, but you're right, provided we don't overdo it. So we can get little stressors that will actually make us a little bit stronger. They'll activate the stem cell population, but if we overdo it, if it's protracted stress, if you turn on APABEC for too long, you're going to start activating that C to T mutation program. You do not want that. When you activate that, you get ADAR overexpression, then you start to clone those premalignant cells. So you can get a little bit, but not too much. So it's that Goldilocks principle. When can we get a little bit that's just right, that strengthens our immune system, and when is it too much where the immune system can't recover? And, you know, we can't always control stress, right? So I'm going to give that back to Alex. Sorry, I just got to get a comment from Alex.
No. Even when they tell you, don't be stressed, it turns out that just doesn't help.
Well, I have to say that, unfortunately, we're out of time for today. I want to take this time to thank our speakers and panelists for their wonderful talks today and for sharing all of their insights. And thanks to everyone for joining us at A Closer Look at Stem Cells in Space.